joined us this morning. You are present at a session with the spine-tingling title of Artist and Repertoire Classical, and I'm your conference chair, Uncle Dave Lewis. Glad to be here.
I don't want the classical music people to get the wrong idea.
And what we're going to do now, we're starting a bit late. I'd like to present our first speaker, who is speaking on the topic of Recording the Renaissance, an Oral History of Early Music and Performance. Roberta Freund-Schwartz is an associate professor of historical musicology at the University of Kansas and advising director of the University of Kansas Archive of Recorded Sound. Her areas of specialization include the music of the Spanish Renaissance, patronage studies, and African-American popular music, jazz, blues, gospel, and rock and roll. She has produced articles on the Spanish Melomane and composer of St. Francis of Borja, the patronage of music by the Spanish nobility in the Renaissance, blues rock songwriting, Meredith Wilson's The Music Man, and the role that British jazz critics played in popularizing African-American music in that country. Her recent monograph, How Britain Got the Blues, The Transmission and Reception of American Blues Style into the United Kingdom, Ashgate 2007, was named the best book on historical research on blues, R&B, or soul recordings by the Association of Recorded Sound Collections in 2008. Will you please welcome Roberta Freund-Schwartz?
I feel like there should be crowd noises now. I can see that some of you are a bit confused. You're probably thinking, aren't you that woman who usually does those papers on blues and British people or unintelligible rock songs? Indeed, I normally do. But I think that it's high time that I introduce to you, my friends at ARSC, my secret alter identity, mild-mannered Renaissance scholar. And in that capacity, I find myself annually facing a group of students trying to convince them that a music history class on the Middle Ages and Renaissance is not just some torturous requirement they have to endure, but in fact has some relevance to them as musicians. And I usually lead with this, that early music is the fastest growing sector of the classical music market. If they would actually like to make a living playing and singing music, their best bet by far is to know their Dolin and Dufay. 'Twas not always thus, though. At the dawn of recorded sound, only a relative handful of early music had been retrieved from archives and libraries, and few, if any, outside a small circle of antiquarians really knew of their existence. And I should clarify here that when I say early, I mean early, not that newfangled stuff by Bach and Handel, which was very famously revived by Mendelssohn and others in the 1830s. And even though aristocratic amateurs with an antiquarian bent had been meeting to perform Palestrina motets and English madrigals since the 1720s, they enjoyed no such celebrated public forum. Ultimately, it was recordings that were the vehicle through which the earliest of early music gained wider exposure. And these recordings, now spanning more than 100 years, reveal a constantly evolving relationship to early music. Now, this may be the oldest recording of early music in existence, recorded at the Sistine Chapel by British Gramophone in 1904. And this is Improperia by Tomás Luis de Victoria. Session is probably most famous for the romantic selections performed by the chapel master at that time, Alessandro Moreschi, known for posterity as the Last Castrato. The Vatican was at the time dominated by Sicilian reformers wishing to restore the glories of Catholic church music, so in addition, they also performed motets on that session by Victoria and by Palestrina. In this regard, though, they were just really catching up to England, where old musical works were being performed regularly and very reverentially. The earliest example of what we might call a historical anthology, a collection of Renaissance and early Baroque works, just known as cathedral music, was published in London in 1778. Other collections emerged during the century, and by 1900, English antiquarians had produced a number of modern editions of medieval and Renaissance works. Therefore, it's not surprising that the majority of acoustic recordings of early music were done by English ensembles. Under the leadership of Sir Richard Terry, the first music master at the new Westminster Cathedral, the choir specialized in performing works by Palestrina, Victoria, Thomas Tallis, William Byrd, and others. Their devotion to this older repertoire, in both services and in recordings, established the reputation of the new cathedral and helped build its congregation. Terry and his choir made their first recordings for his master's voice in 1907. This selection, a motet by Palestrina called Nunc Dimittis, was recorded in 1924.
Non dimittis verbum tuum, Domine, secundum verbum tuum in pace.
Quia videbum oculi me.
I love the portamento. It's like barbershop Palestrina. Terry, along with Edmund H. Fellows, who began publishing a multi-volume edition of English madrigals in 1901, inspired a kind of Elizabethan fever that swept through England after the First World War. Of the performing ensembles that began to populate church groups and university campuses, the most extensively recorded was a group called the English Singers, a vocal ensemble that began performing at St. Martin's in the Fields, still very much a hotbed of early music, but they very shortly devoted themselves to touring and recording. This is their charming version of Thomas Bateson's Cupid on a Bed of Roses, also for his master's voice. Technology and the Depression-era collapse of the commercial recording industry paradoxically yielded a dramatic increase in the number of early music recordings by way of essentially recorded historical anthologies. The first was the Columbia History of Music for the Ear and Eye, launched by composer Percy Scholes. It would eventually span the entire history of Western music, but the initial offerings, 878 double-sided discs, covered music from plain chant to the early 17th century. Scholes, like many of his era, were inspired by a guy named Arnold Dolmetsch, about whom more will be said in just a second. Before launching his 125-disc Anthologie Sonore in 1933, the Belgian musicologist Kurt Sax began to arrange for the recording of historical works by fellow travelers in Germany. In 1931, Parlophone released a preliminary collection entitled 2,000 Years of Music, a concise history of the development of music from the earliest times through the 18th century, concisely presented on 12 78 RPM discs. Expectation of the familiarity of listeners with the repertoire covered was so low that, in fact, song titles aren't given on the album, just a relative time period and a geographical location. So this is early Netherlands music, circa 1500. An Et Incarnatus Est from a mass by Jean Scandepre, though because of the heavy vibrato, the portamento, and the glacially slow tempo, even I, who has more than a passing familiarity with Jean Scand, can't positively identify which mass. I have a couple of possibilities. However, it is evident.
Is there any merit to the Netherlands name for Just Kent of Praise?
Well, he's from the Netherlands.
He was?
Yes.
I thought he was
French. A Franco-Netherlandish composer. Technically, yes. From the very northern part of France, which was part of the Low Countries, which just at the time was called the Franco-Netherlandish area of Flanders. But it's pretty obvious that even with this very slow recording, that the ensemble, which is the Berlin State Academy Choir, is approaching the work in much the same way that they would any other work that they performed. Performances from this era often use contemporary performance styles, and they were often arranged freely. So freely, in fact, that a better term for them is probably an expressive version. A term that Manuel de Falla used for his own adaptations of Victoria. A good example is this recording of Alma Redem Turris Mater by Guillaume Dufay, recorded by Pro Musica Brussels under the direction of Safford Cape and originally released as part of the Anthology Sonore. This is plain chant, by the way. I can't absolutely tell you if that's an organ or an accordion. I'm about divided on opinion. But this sort of thing was really typical of the late 19th and early 20th century approach to early music. It was commonly believed that if pre-classical works were performed as written, if such a thing were even possible, that they wouldn't be palatable to modern audiences. Therefore, works were arranged for modern ensembles. Additional parts were added and dramatic cuts were made. And, you know, this was done by irresponsible people like Mendelssohn and Mozart. Editors, particularly devoted to seeing their works in print, and seeing them performed, like Edmund Fellowes, added a lot of the instructions that just simply aren't a part of early music manuscripts. Things like accidentals, tempo, dynamic markings, accents, and instrumentation. And then Fellowes, in particular, added helpful piano and organ accompaniments and singer-friendly transpositions that often took works that were conceived modally, just took their rough tonal equivalent and then transposed that up three or four steps because it was easier to sing. Now, the results can be orally pleasing, but to me there's something a little bit unconvincing about them as well. This is Fellowes directing his own choir, the St. George's Singers, doing The Silver Swan by Orlando Gibbons. Bought pop records, I'm sure that sounded wonderful. Just doesn't sound a whole lot like the late Renaissance. There was, however, an alternative. Championed by Arnold Dolmetsch, the first early music aficionado of the recording age to propose, quote, setting aside intolerant modernity, unquote, and trying to perform works in the way that the composer intended them to be heard. To him, this meant consulting writings of the period to learn how musicians of the day approached a score before then forming his own artistic interpretation. And it absolutely meant that in as much as possible, the work should be performed on period instruments, whose tone colors Dolmetsch describes in rapturous terms in his 1916 book, The Interpretation of Music of the 17th and 18th Centuries, Revealed by Contemporary Evidence. A true antiquarian eccentric, Dolmetsch collected period instruments that he bought at auctions and got from God knows where else, and learned how to repair and remake them. And he also turned his extended family into a period orchestra complete with Renaissance costumes. The gentleman in the dress in the front is actually Arnold Dolmetsch. Why the dress, I have no idea. A series of, his home in Hasselmere became a destination for those interested in new and different ways of performing old music. A series of wax cylinders made in 1904 at Hasselmere, unfortunately, have been lost, and discs that were recorded for his master's voice in 1921 were never issued, and the master's lost. So the earliest extant recordings we have of the Dolmetsch clan are from 1929. And this is a little bit of Thomas Wilkes' fantasy for a chest or an ensemble of six viols. These recordings to be important and sometimes stirring, but they judged that less informed listeners would find them really quite dull. Some probably did, though the pace of early music releases increased rather significantly during the 1930s. Leafing through the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia of Recorded Music in the year 1936, one encounters a surprisingly wide variety of early music, from Léonin, the 13th century chapel master of Notre Dame in Paris, to Orlando de Lassus, writing at the very end of the 16th century, from John Dunstable to Gil Vinchois, to Gesualdo and Gabrielli, and even competing versions of less than mainstream works like Josquin's Ave Vera Virginitas and Dufay's Alma Radiam Torus Mater. These records inspired musicians who were not immersed in the old music culture to engage with the repertoire. And some of the names of Dolmetsch pilgrims and pupils up here, some rather famous names, and one that I have omitted, who generated really probably the most famous artifact of these explorations. This is Nadia Boulanger conducting an ensemble of eight students at the piano in 1937, and I apologize, I could only find it on YouTube. And the video's not really much. She's on just the piano with a cello. Held up remarkably well. Boulanger was one of an ever-widening number of musicians interested in performing early music. And by the early 1940s, the historical repertoire had really become a part of the mainstream of classical music. Network radio, and particularly in Europe, played a really significant part in exposing aficionados of Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms to earlier works. The BBC Third program in particular is frequently cited as the driving force that made London really the early music capital of the world, and it really still retains that title to this day. Among the artists it promoted was Alfred Deller, the first singer to cultivate a career as a countertenor, or a tenor singing in the artificially high range to fill the parts that used to be sung by castrati, who seem to be in rather short supply these days. His strikingly beautiful tone and palpable presence is evident in this recording of Can She Accuse My Wrongs by John Dowland.
Can she excuse my wrongs with that you spoke? Shall I call the good when she proves unkind?
You'll notice far less vibrato. Very much a spin to a very push to the front voice, but something very definitely has changed in the approach to early music. And it marks the beginning of what we would think of as the modern early music movement based on Dolmetsch's notion of historically faithful approaches that were disseminated by the great man's children and grandchildren. This approach gained considerable currency with the 1958 recording of the 12th century miracle play, The Play of Daniel, by New York Pro Musica Antiqua under the directorship of Noah Greenberg. The obvious enthusiasm of the performers and the highly professional approach, which Some early music groups were kind of criticized as being a little amateur. This really established that professional musicians could deliver this early music in a very convincing way. And this is a work that's monophonic. It's just a melody. And this recording, I think, has a vibrancy and appeal that's still obvious, even 50 years after.
Jubilemus regi nostrum magnoma potenti. Praise the Jesus, the Regina, Monte competenti. Resonantium cum naturba solemnibus odis. Sica vincent noventatus sine solemnonis.
Okay, we can question the tambourine, but the string accompaniment, absolutely appropriate for the period. Greenbird's ensemble was one of a growing number devoted to early music. Nicholas's Hennenkort's Conscientious Musicus, the Consort of Music, Christopher Hogwood's Academy of Ancient Music, and the Studier der Frühen Musik, directed by Thomas Binkley. Binkley was the first early music performer to approach authenticity ethnomusicologically. Instead of relying on written documentation, he looked to living traditions in countries that had had some connection with medieval and Renaissance Europe, specifically Northern Africa and the Middle East. This is an excerpt of their performance of Ashantar by Beatrice, the Countess of Dia, that is her picture with the shiny gold in the background. And this is the only extant melody by a trobaritz, the female troubadours. Mostly we just have their poetry. It's a 2 minute long introduction, so I'm just going to play this little sample. These recordings were historically plausible, in my professional opinion. And they added an exciting and a really vital quality to a lot of early music that captured the attention of a lot of listeners. They were also extremely controversial and still are somewhat controversial today. A competing group of early music performers took the notion of basing performance on period practices far more seriously. Anything that could not be corroborated by documentation from the era in which the works were composed, including any sort of personal interpretation, was eliminated from consideration. Adopting the sobriquet of authentic performance, they were committed to, quote, stripping away the layers of discolored varnish to reveal the true colors, unquote, of early works. By the mid-1960s, this austere approach had come to dominate early music recordings. An admittedly extreme expression of this viewpoint is found in a program note by Erwin Bodke for the Cambridge Music Society of the early 1950s. I quote, "Early music was a highly aristocratic art, and restraint governed even the display of emotion. This deprives concerts of early music of the atmosphere of electricity that, when present, is one of the finest experiences in the modern concert hall. Who seeks but this may stay away from our concerts? We want to take this opportunity to thank the artists for their voluntary restraint in their display of artistic capabilities, which they exercise when recreating with us the atmosphere of equanimity, tranquility, and noble entertainment, which is the characteristic of early music," unquote. I can tell you, I've researched a lot of noble courts, and none of those terms would apply, even remotely. The new champions of this restrained authenticity quickly found a market niche, and a wider variety of genres and styles not previously recorded finally entered the modern consciousness. However, the serious academic approach too often yielded ascetic renderings at dirge-like tempos that were nonetheless embraced by critics and record buyers as faithful reproductions. A fine example is this version of the program chanson La Guerre by Clément Jeannequin that's meant to recreate orally the Battle of Marignan.
Oh.
And from this recording, we can only assume that this was the slowest and most dispassionate military conflict in the history of the world. However, the authentic approach also yielded performances that, when shorn of excess vibrato, modern instrumentation, and other modern affectations, revealed the sublime and delicate beauty of pure a cappella counterpoint, as in this recording of Ave Maria Virgo Serena by Josquin des Prez by Le Chapelle Royale. Since the 1980s, a more eclectic approach has dominated the recording of early music, as even the most stalwart devotees of authenticity began to acknowledge that no such thing was actually possible, something critics of the movement had been pointing out for 30 years at that point. Michael Morrow, the director of the ensemble Musica Reservata, very famously said this: supposing a medieval or Renaissance listener could hear a modern performance of a chanson by Binchois or a Dolan lute solo, I think he would probably say either, how can anyone ruin such fine music in this way? Or, more likely, what the hell is that? A better understanding of period performance practices has revealed that as much as anything, what was truly authentic in music before 1600 was complete flexibility and a wide range of possible performance styles. So I'd like to close with a little demonstration that I do for my students, actually, on the first day of class. I play them five versions of this song, Fate la Parte, by the Spanish Renaissance composer Juan de la Encina. I usually ask them which one is the most authentic. For us, I'll just tell you, these are all equally valid interpretations based on historical documentation. The translation is up here, fatal news, everyone hear this, the wife of Mr. Cotal is dead because he found her in bed with a Spaniard, and he killed her. But he escaped out the window by dint of guile and cunning. This was probably, in my estimation, a favorite song of King Ferdinand's, because the Spaniard gets away with something and gets out the window. Just a few seconds of each of these. Serious version with heavy percussion. Now an ensemble called Constantinople. Same song. So something like a variation for strings. Now a group called the Fires of Love. Bada! We can assume that they're recreating a performance in an enormous chapel of some sort based on the reverb. My personal favorite version, the King Singers. So going straight for the humorous part of the song, even in the introduction, and then Esperion 21, a group about which I will admit I have conflicting opinions. We have kind of a combination of all of the approaches here. Now they're going to speed it up a little bit. Thank you.
We will not tarry long, but before we move to the next speaker, does anyone have any questions of Roberta?
Yes.
I noticed there's a lack of wind instruments. There's a lack of anything there, yeah. I noticed a lack of wind instruments, particularly Renaissance wind instruments, recorders, crumb horns. Even some of the early brass, and I'm wondering, is that typical for most of the period of early recording, or is that
For most of early recording, yes. The sort of modern recorder ensemble that we all, when we think Collegium Musicum or early music, you get that recorder sound in your ears. That comes along really in this sort of early music era, starting in about 1955, 1958. What's largely happened, though, is there's a segmentation there. People who do instrumental early music and people who do vocal early music, and they do not mix very often. So if there is instrumental accompaniment, it's usually percussion, viols of some sort, maybe a trombone standing for a sack, but usually very little under the vocal recordings.
So you think that's more of a personal choice then, that they just don't mix those, or is it a historical choice?
There's a debate that's been raging for about 20 years now, but the a cappella heresy that... Mm-hmm. The notion got instilled very early that all early vocal music from before 1600 should have been performed a cappella, no instrumentation at all. The more documentation we find, the more that we know that that's not true, but it's so ingrained that it's changing very, very slowly.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Interesting that these records, which weren't in existence prior to the 20th century, create a new orthodoxy of their own that couldn't possibly have been there in any of the preceding centuries. So I think it's possible, as in those five versions of those songs, mm-hmm. they probably represent 5,000 versions if that song was a hit. Because how would anybody in one village knew what people were doing to the song in the next village? It would be like playing St. Louis blues today. You could do it any way you wanted.
Absolutely, and very much historically, through my research, I found that the pickup group is actually the preferred ensemble of the Renaissance, that instrumentation was completely ad hoc based on who was around and what they had at their disposal. So, you know, we got three Shawn players and a sack butt, let's do it. Nobody's got an instrument, let's do it a cappella. You know, whatever would get that song performed, because they didn't care. Yes?
And that sort of serves one of the flaws.
Even a great work like Messiah is done these days. Every published recording has to be a specific performance, the 1741 Dublin or the whichever the London performance, the Westminster Abbey performance. But even the prolific, or not prolific, I guess, but the various versions which are available shows that every time Messiah was done in the 18th century, it was done differently.
Oh, absolutely.
So why today are we staying so strictly to these various half dozen versions that are issued, rather than, you know, they're sort of saying that any modern interpretation of Messiah is musical pornography. It, you know, might be give you a thrill, but it's not right.
The authenticity movement, I think, because there were so many scholars involved and scholarly documentation played such an important
role. You mean recently?
Even when this started in the 1960s.
Yeah. Well, that's what I meant. Recently, as opposed to 200.
Have been shockingly enduring.
I didn't get the first half of that sentence.
You know, I get that this authenticity movement took itself very, very seriously. Those ramifications are still very much with us. I have sophomores that I teach to who somehow have gotten the notion that there is one way to perform historical works, and you have to do it that way or it's wrong.
But we haven't found it.
And even after 16 weeks of deprogramming, some of them still leave with that idea. So there is a certain homogeneity has really established itself.
A lot of the performances seem to have amusical priorities, like the Christopher Hogwood Messiah. Mm-hmm. He had a chorus which was the same as whatever performance he was duplicating.
Yeah.
But because the soloists were taken from the choir, he put one extra singer in each section of the choir to make up for the soloists, who are actually professional soloists. They weren't from the choir. But once again, this doesn't really add any benefit to the listening of the work. It's just sort of a historical novelty almost.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I would agree.
I'm afraid that the axe must fall at the moment.
Be happy to talk to any of you after the session.
Thank you very much.